Chapter 46. Marcy was booked for a weekend photography show at the Sheraton, so she and Jack loaded up his car at her house and headed into Waikiki. Summers' mood was light. It had been that way since he received the email 4 days earlier. Jack had downloaded the parental authorization form, signed it, scanned it, and immediately returned it by email. Soon Deb would pick up Sophie. And if he managed to stay under the radar, he'd figure out a way to get Sophie out to the islands. After she was healthy and stabilized, he would get her back to Deborah and turn himself in. He knew that sooner or later law enforcement would catch up to him. He couldn't run forever, and he didn't want to. Turning himself in and confessing was the right thing to do. He dropped Marcy at the hotel and drove to the coral reef, parking his car on the street in front of the motel office. He was on his way up to his room when Glenn stopped him.
"Say, Mr. Wilson, you had some visitors a couple days ago."
"Visitors?" Jack's face immediately flushed.
"Yeah, man. One said he was a cousin of yours. They showed me your picture and asked if you was living here or if I seen you."
"Cousin? I don't have any cousins." Jack's adrenaline was pumping. "What did you tell them?" Glenn put his hand on Jack's shoulder.
"Don't worry, man. Old Glenn's got your back. Them fucking bill collectors will say anything. I know from experience. I told them I ain't never seen anybody look like that picture."
"Thanks, Glenn. You did the right thing. Why do you suppose they came here to the coral reef? Did they tell you?" Glenn shook his head.
"Nah, they just said they was your cousins, and they were pretty sure you was living here. But I seen them going to the breakers across the street, so maybe they don't really know where you live."
"What did they look like? Did they show you any ID?"
"Well, they weren't cops, that I could tell you. They didn't show me any badges or ID cards, and they talked with some funny foreigner accent, like they was from Europe, maybe Russia. And Mr. Wilson, they called you Mr. Summerfield, or something like that. They didn't even know your right name, but they did have your picture."
"Thanks a lot, Glenn, I owe you. If they come by again, just tell them you never heard of me."
"Don't have to worry a bit. I ain't helping out no bill collectors."
Jack went into his room and packed his suitcase, removing every trace of his tenancy. He threw the bag into the car and went back into the office. "Glenn, here's the rent for the next 2 months." Jack laid $1,600 on the counter. "And here's an extra $500 for you. You never heard of me, right?" Glenn smiled widely.
"Heard of who?"
Summers then drove back to the Sheraton, where he sat in the corner of the bar with a cocktail, trying to settle his nerves. After Marcy's show, while they were loading her photographs into his trunk, she said,
"What's wrong, Jack? You look like you've seen a ghost."
"Some guys came snooping around the coral reef and showed the manager my picture."
"I thought no one knows where you're staying."
"Don't know how they did it. No one knew, not even my sister." "Damn! The last email message said they were close to bringing Sophie home. They needed my authorization. I sent it to them."
"Why do you think it's them? Maybe it's the police."
Jack shook his head. "Glenn said they didn't have any IDs and they spoke with a European accent." "It's them, all right."
"Glenn would know that? A European accent?"
"He said they sounded Russian. He said they were asking about me, even knew my name. Except in Glenn's mind, they said Summerfield."
"You sure you haven't told anybody where you are?"
"Nobody." Jack shook his head. "If they were truly speaking with a Russian accent, I got a pretty good idea who they are. But it doesn't make any sense. I just got an email saying they were bringing Sophie home. Why would they be out looking for me?"
"Jack, you're scaring me. You're the third person, the only one left who knows about the theft. The only one who can tie them to the murders."
Summers slipped into the driver's seat and started driving in the direction of the North Shore. "Do you think they could have traced my cell phone or my computer? What if that's how they caught up to me?" Summers pulled off the highway.
"What are you doing?
If they can find the coral reef, why can't they find your house?"
What if they traced me through phone records? I used my cell phone at your house. There are phone calls between you and me. We have to think this through.
Jack, you told me that you and your sister have safe cell phones. They were purchased by other people and no one knows the numbers.
That's true. Maybe they found me through the internet. They could have traced me when I went online to check for email.
That's paranoid. How would these guys have that kind of equipment? If that stuff even exists. I mean, maybe if you were in an internet cafe and they could trace the connection, that's it.
I always went online from the coffee shop around the corner. That must be why they were searching through the neighborhood.
Did you ever go online from my house? From my internet connection?
Summers thought for a minute and shook his head. No. Never, not even on my phone.
Then how would they know about me? We'll be safe in my house. I'll lock my doors.
Lock your doors? Seriously? Whoever these people are, they're killers, not burglars. They killed two people and now they know where I am.
I don't think they do. They were canvassing the neighborhood. They don't know anything about Eugene Wilson. They were asking about a guy named Summerfield. They don't know about me or where I live. You didn't make contact from my house. You're a needle in a haystack. There's a million people out here.
Maybe. But I sure can't go back to the coral reef. I'll have to stay somewhere else.
You can stay at my house. Lay low for a while until they leave the island.
Thanks for the offer, but I'm going to find another place to stay for a while. It might be best if we didn't see each other.
I'm not afraid.
They have no idea who I am. He started the car. We need to think this through.
Chapter 47. Liam entered Abu Hamad's antiquity store before noon. As before, there were no customers.
Jamal, he called.
The old man shuffled out from the back room.
Assalamu alaikum.
And peace be upon you.
Abu Hamad smiled, nodded, turned, and retreated to his back room without an additional word. Liam followed and stood patiently by the wooden chair, while Abu Hamad brewed his tea. When both were seated, Abu Hamad spoke.
Of course, I do not know everyone in Hebron, but I believe if an arrangement for a ransom or payoff was in place, certain people would know. Even so, in discussing this matter, one must be cautious. One may only broach the topic from a distance, like jackals circle their prey.
He shook his head.
But so far I have learned nothing. People speak of the doctor's love for the little child, not of an arrangement to pay money. They dismiss the notion that he would agree to sell her, even back to her father.
Thank you, Jamal. I am grateful for your efforts. I suppose the next question is, would he consider return of the child if he were offered a great deal of money? Perhaps many millions? I could arrange it.
Abu Hamad leaned back, and with his weathered fingers stroked the whiskers in his goatee. He took a long, wheezy breath through his nose and wagged his index finger up and down.
You know, Liam, for many, many years, Hebron was just a simple town, a marketplace for Bedouins. There they could come and buy water bags, wine, cloth, shoes, provisions they would need. There they could sell their sheep and goats, or the milk and cheese they made. In many ways, Hebron is still a simple town. But Arif, he is different. He stands in his walled palace and looks down upon the peasants in the town. He is wealthy beyond the imagination of most Hebronites. Many millions would make a difference to almost everyone in this poor town, and surely in other towns as well. He shrugged his shoulders. But maybe not to Arif.
One never knows, though. Eh, Jamal? Who knows how he spends his money? Let me ask a more difficult question. How would I get word to Dr. Al-Zahani that I would be interested in proposing such an arrangement? I'm sure there would be a generous payment to you as well.
I want nothing from such commerce. Were it not for the little one, I would send you on your way. But I am troubled for Sophie. Myself. I have been the target of Arif's anger. I have seen the demon in him.
and a man such as Arif could surely fill a child with hate.
I'm sorry if I offended you, Jamal. Liam rose and reached into his back pocket. He handed Abu Hamad a business card. I meant no harm in offering to pay you for your help. I'm only trying to reunite a daughter with her father. Here's my contact information. If you learn something you think I should know, I'd appreciate a call.
I took no offense. I will help if I can because it is right, not because I seek to profit. You should know there are many good, honest people on this side of the barrier. People who seek only the right to live in peace.
Liam nodded. I am honored to know such a man. Chapter 48. Fakir led young Danny into the apartment's front room, where the sons of Canaan were seated in a circle. One by one, the members of the group welcomed the 16-year-old and offered him tea and date-filled cakes. Danny was confused and scared.
"Sit, please, Danny," Faiz said, pointing to an empty chair. "Join us."
The old man's whiskered face wrinkled with a beneficent smile. Danny nodded tentatively and took the empty seat beside Al-Zahani, who patted him on the shoulder. Faiz continued.
"You probably wonder why you have been brought upstairs, when you usually guard the door for us, no?"
The boy nodded.
"Danny, we would like to invite you to have a very important role in our project."
"Very important," echoed Nizar.
"What do you know about jihad, Danny?"
The boy shrugged.
"It's our continuing struggle in the case of Allah."
Faiz smiled broadly and nodded.
"And we understand our struggle to be for the cause of truth, don't we? A true jihadist is a warrior whose whole purpose is to establish the truth. You understand that, don't you, Danny?"
He nodded reflexively, unsure where all this was leading. Faiz leaned back in his chair and folded his hands on his stomach. His ample beard covered his chest.
"That is good. Do you know the meaning of Shahid, son?"
Danny shook his head slowly. Faiz spoke gently.
"A Shahid is one who seeks the truth and witnesses it. He dedicates himself to the truth and is prepared to fight and give up his life for the cause of truth. That is why a Shahada, a martyrdom, guarantees that a Shahid shall know paradise and be exonerated from the torments of the grave.
And let's not forget 72 dark-eyed virgins," added Nizar with a sly smile.
"Is that actually true?"
Danny said, finally grasping the meaning of his presence. Faiz nodded.
"It is written. The Shahid will be wed to the Ori and will not know the torments of the grave."
Danny looked around the room. All eyes were focused on him, and all were smiling paternally.
"The concept of Shahada is very similar to the concept of prophethood," continued Faiz. "Both martyrs and prophets are paradigms. They are examples. They are models for us all. Do you follow me, Danny?"
"I'm not sure. I don't think so."
"Shahids are the leaders who spearhead our struggle. They embody truth. Martyrs are elite models of the divine message. They ensure the success in our struggle for the cause of Allah. Danny, you can become such a mujahid."
"You want me to blow myself up?"
the boy said in a shaky voice.
"No, Danny."
"Whew," he said with a smile. I thought Faiz raised his finger.
"We want you to join us in our holy struggle. Are you with us?"
"Sure,"
Danny said slowly.
"We have developed a weapon, a very potent weapon, much more devastating than a bomb. But it needs to be tested."
Danny swallowed hard.
"You want me to test this weapon?"
Faiz nodded deeply with a smile.
"We will honor you with that opportunity. Is it dangerous?"
"Very."
It will take the courage of a true martyr. That is why we look to you, Dani.
Would I have to die?
Everyone looked to Al-Zahani, who nodded.
I'm afraid so. It's irreversible.
Dani moved around uncomfortably on his chair.
I don't know. I have a lot of things I have to do. My mom needs me. Your family will be well taken care of,
Faiz said warmly.
They will be given a home and a place of honor in Hebron. Your sisters will have money to attend school. Your memory will be cherished by all.
And you'll be given paradise, added Nizar.
Can I think about this? Of course,
Faiz said.
Think about it, but tell no one. Can we count on you to be silent?
Dani nodded.
Not even your mother,
Fakir said.
Our holy struggle depends on secrecy.
And if I don't want to do this?
Faiz spread his hands.
Then you can go back to watching the door like before.
The group stood. Nizar came up to Dani and put his hands on his shoulders.
Be a hero to our people. Your family will be honored forever. And you, Dani? Well, 72 virgins is not so bad, hmm?
Come back tomorrow, Dani,
said Faiz.
Let us know your decision.
Dani turned to leave the room, but Nizar put his arm around him.
Let us all join hands.
The group stood in a circle, hand in hand. Dani between Nizar and Faiz, and chanted,
From the river to the sea, from the Golan to the Gulf, we will take Jerusalem brick by brick, stone by stone, until the land is once more ours.
You are one of us, Dani, said Rami,
and the boy beamed with pride. They patted his back as he left the room, albeit a little unsteady on his feet.
Will he betray us? Asked Rami.
I have no doubt he will discuss this all with his mother. We will have to dispose of her, no matter what his decision,
Faiz said, retaking his seat.
He then turned to Al-Zahani.
Be prepared to run the test tomorrow when he returns.
I am already prepared. But what if he decides not to volunteer?
Faiz shook his head.
We will run the test with him regardless.
Everyone nodded. As they stood to leave, Rami said,
I have one more piece of good news.
As you know, Ghanim applied for a job in the pharmacy department of Haifa's B'nai Zion Hospital.
Well, yesterday,
his application was approved, and he will start in June.
Faiz smiled.
Allah shines on us today. We will hit Tel Aviv and Haifa in July. Arif, you must step up production, day and night.
Understood.
Chapter 49. Mother Nature dangled a taste of spring in the face of Chicagoans on a mid-March afternoon, but it was just a teaser. The thermometer climbed into the high 50s, and winter coats and scarves were set aside for cotton jackets. Though St. Paddy's Day had come and gone, the Chicago River still flowed with vestiges of Kelly green. The fountain in Daly Plaza still bubbled green water, and the tops of downtown buildings still lit up like four-leaf clovers. Just a teaser, for the Northeast Hawk would soon return to Michigan Avenue, and the snow would blow a few more times before winter would loosen its grip. On North Clark Street, a mother held the door open while her son struggled on his crutches and entered the law offices of Catherine Lockhart.
We're here to see Attorney Lockhart, the woman said to the receptionist. Please tell her that Darius and Violet McCord are here.
A moment later, Catherine came out to her lobby.
Very nice to meet you both. And,
Darius, I confess I don't know much about college basketball, but I was saddened to read about the assault and your tragic injury. Have they caught the assailants?
No, ma'am,
Violet said.
That's why we're here. Darius has something he wants to tell you.
Catherine gestured toward the hallway.
Come on back to my office and we'll talk. Gladys, will you please get them both a soft drink?
I'll just have water, thank you,
Violet said. Violet helped Darius settle into one of the two client chairs opposite Catherine's desk. Gladys brought in the drinks and closed the door on her way out.
Again, Darius, it pains me to see you struggle with those crutches. When do the doctors think you'll be up and around?
I don't know, he said sheepishly. Maybe a few months.
Do the police have any leads? Any way to find out who did this?
Violet leaned forward, putting her forearms on the desk. She was thin and tall, but still considerably shorter than her son. She appeared to be no older than her late 30s.
Miss Lockhart, what we tell you today, is it a secret?
Catherine nodded her head.
Yes, it is. It's confidential and privileged. And call me Catherine. That means you can't tell no one if we don't want you to?
That's right.
Are you the attorney in the case against Mr. Kelson?
Catherine nodded.
I'm defending a client that's being sued by Mr. Kelson's company. So you're against him, right? I've been reading about it in the paper.
Catherine smiled.
I guess you could say I'm against him.
It's his company. Violet sat back in her chair.
Then you're the right person.
She unscrewed the cap on her water bottle, took a drink and a deep breath.
Miss Lockhart, I need to tell you about my son and me. We've been down a long, hard road. You probably don't know what families have to do to get their boys into Division I basketball.
No, Violet, I don't.
Well, it starts when they're babies. From the time Darius was just a squeaker, he had talent. I could see it. Everybody could. When he was old enough to hold a ball, he had to have a ball in his hands. It was like him and the ball was one. All the time, bouncing a ball. Off the floor, off the walls.
Violet smiled at her son.
I wanted him to be a good ball player, as good as he could be. Everybody in our part of town dreams of their baby playing pro ball. But I didn't have any idea what we were getting into.
Tears came to her eyes. She wiped them with the back of her hand. Catherine took out a box of tissues and set them on the desk.
He was only 8 years old, and there were scouts on the 47th Street playground talking this way and that. 8 years old, and they come to watch Darius. When he got into the fourth grade, I got a call from Mr. Robinson. We want Darius to be on our AAU team, the Chicago Tigers, he said. One of the best in the country.
At 9 years old? Violet nodded.
I didn't know anything about the AAU, but the other mothers told me if Darius wants to be anybody at all, he's got to sign up. So we did. Before I know it, there were shoes, jerseys, strength equipment, all delivered to my apartment. They put us in touch with Father Paul over at Holy Resurrection so we could use the gym in the afternoon. Every day, all year, Miss Lockhart, except for the time he was practicing with the team. And then we still would go out at night sometimes. Darius would come home from school and go straight to the gym. 300 layups, 400 free throws, 300 spot-ups. I stood under the basket and fed him the ball. Then we'd go home and have our dinner at 8.
She looked at her son.
He was ranked as the second-best 10-year-old in the country by Youth Hoops magazine.
The second-best 10-year-old?
Yep. From time to time, this coach or that would come over to the church and work with Darius. It was all a business to them, but I could see they were teaching him and getting him ready for college and pro ball. Who's paying all these people? I don't know. And I guess I don't need to tell you about all the sneaky agents who ain't supposed to be talking to kids, want me to sign their papers. AAU took us all over the country, Miss Lockhart.
Catherine.
Tournaments almost every week. New York, Washington, Dallas, L.A. His baby brother, at first I could bring him, because he'd sit on my lap. But later he's too big and I don't have the money. And I have to stay at home or get people to watch him.
Violet's eyes glassed over, and her voice would occasionally seize up.
Terrell, he didn't get the attention he needed growing up. He needed attention too, but there was no more me to go around.
She took a few pieces of tissue and rocked a bit in her seat.
Now he's in and out of trouble.
Catherine waited while Violet composed herself. Darius sat with his head bowed.
By the time Darius was ready for high school,
He had played hundreds of games and everybody wanted him. We had coaches from private high schools sitting in our front room from the time he was in seventh grade. Catholic schools offer him full tuition. One of them even said they'd pick him up and drive him to school every day. High school up in Maryland would have moved us to an apartment in Baltimore. An academy in Florida showed us pictures of first-rounders and told us he could stay in the dorm. Major university lab school. He'd live right on the campus. Darius didn't want Catholic school. He didn't want no academy or lab school. He wanted to be with his friends and play in the public league. You may have read about him when he was at Jefferson. He was a high school All-American and ranked number 22 in the country in his senior year. Number 4 point guard. Then there's certain days when the colleges can come visit you. Mercy me, you'd have thought we was the king and queen of England. Letters from people in places we never heard of. They'll all be your best friend. I get it. No, ma'am, you don't. You see, every last one of them is sitting in our front room, all saying that the years of practice and sacrifice is going to finally pay off. Someday, Darius, you're going to play in the NBA, and we're going to get you there. Then you'll be able to take care of yourself, your baby brother, and your mama. This is your ticket out, they say. So we keep working, Miss Lockhart, day in, day out, keeping up the basketball, keeping up the grades so he can get into college and not sit a year. 23 on his ACTs, always a B average. He wants to go to St. Joe's because it's right in town, and I can come see him every game. 2 years at St. Joe's. He didn't want to be no one and done. He stayed the extra year for Coach Washburn. Now comes the tournament. He's showing everyone he's the best, a first rounder for sure. We made it. Violet gave a quick pop to Darius' shoulder. Tell her, Darius, she said sternly. Tell her what you and Marcus Fields did. Darius hung his head even farther and talked so softly he was almost inaudible. We took money. Violet looked crossly at her son. Tell her what you did for that money. We shaved points. He looked up. We never lost on purpose and we never threw a game, but we did shave points. We controlled the score. Catherine leaned forward. What does this have to do with Mr. Kelson, Darius? He's the one. He gave us the money. And I know we weren't the first. He's been hanging around St. Joe's for years. After a pause in the room, Violet popped Darius again. You ain't done, Darius. Last week we played Western Alabama in the tournament. We were supposed to keep the score under 14, but I scored too many points, and Mr. Kelson got real mad. He did this to me. Mr. Kelson broke your leg? It was the Russian dude. Hit me with a pipe in Mr. Kelson's car. Miss Lockhart, Kelson is in with those Russian gangsters, Violet said. A man named Dmitri. Tell her, Darius. Darius swallowed hard. Mr. Kelson plays the points with some Russians. The main dude is Dmitri, but I don't know his last name. And Dmitri broke your leg? Catherine asked. Nah, that was Yevgeny. I seen him a few times when we was on the road. I ain't never seen Dmitri at a game. Did you tell this to the police? We don't want to do that, Violet said. Darius's leg is broke, but it's not a career-ending break. He'll be better in a few months. We probably have to skip the draft this year, so Darius will be back at St. Joe's next year. Darius can't admit to no one he was taking money. Sports bribery's a federal crime. He'd be kicked out of school. No NBA team would want him. It'd be the end of Darius's career. Then why are you telling me this? Because Mr. Kelson and his Russian friends have been messing up kids' lives, and they'll keep doing it. And they won't think twice about busting up my boy again next year if he don't play along. And maybe they keep doing it even when he's in the pros. You got a case against Mr. Kelson. When does that case come up in court? Catherine spread her hands and smiled. We're in the Cook County courts. Trial is at least a year away. But there's a status call next week. Will Mr. Kelson be there for the status call? You never know with Mr. Kelson, but I don't think so. It's just intended for the lawyers. Somehow you gotta get the word to him that people be knowing what he does.
then he'll have to let Darius alone, because then if something happens to my boy, everybody will know it was him. Mr. Kelson's only able to control people because he does it in secret. He won't commit a crime in a fishbowl.
We're scheduled to do depositions starting next week. I suppose I could slide a comment in here or there, but if I do, I might be opening a door. One way or another, it could lead to people finding out about Darius and what you told me today. I can't guarantee the information will remain confidential. And maybe it even would put Darius in danger.
We'll take that chance. He's already in danger. And I don't think Mr. Kelson's going to do anything if he knows other people are watching him.
Really, Mrs. McCord, I think if you went to the police...
No, ma'am. Officially, Darius was mugged. We just need this Mr. Kelson to leave Darius alone. You get the message to him some way, that you know all about him and Dimitri. He's gotta stop. Otherwise, he'll control my boy forever.
Violet stood and helped Darius to his feet. He looked at Catherine.
I'm sorry, Miss Lockhart, for what I did. I truly am.
Chapter 50.
What if he doesn't show up today? Rami said.
He'll be here,
answered Faiz from a seat in the corner. The old man leaned back on his futon, his hands folded on his belly.
Of that I am sure. But I don't know if he'll have the resolve to submit willingly.
And if he doesn't? Nizar said.
Faiz looked to Al-Zahani, who nodded, reached into his bag, and extracted a syringe in a small bottle with opaque liquid.
It's a short-term sedative.
Donnie returned to the apartment at noon and was warmly greeted by the group.
A warrior has arrived. Hail to the hero, Nizar said. From the river to the sea, Donnie?
Donnie spoke directly to Faiz.
I don't think I can do what you ask. I am not a suicide bomber.
It's not a bomb, Donnie. It's a very potent weapon, like nothing the world has seen, that will bring us great glory. Your family will be very proud. My mother doesn't want me to do this. Even though you'd buy her a house. She told me not to come back here, but I promised I would, so here I am. I'll help in other ways, but not by doing this. I'll guard the door for you. I'll run messages. But I'm not going to let you kill me. I'm not doing it.
Faiz rose from his chair. He put his arms around Donnie in a strong hug and kissed him on the cheek.
We are all very proud of you. Allah will surely grant your entrance into Jannah.
From behind, Al-Zahani inserted the needle into Donnie's neck and quickly plunged the sedative. Donnie's eyes widened. He tried to speak, but his body went limp in Faiz's arms.
We need to get him to the lab within an hour, Al-Zahani said.
The group placed Donnie onto a blanket and carried him outside, where he was laid in the backseat of Rami's car.
You know old Abu Hamad?
Fakir said to Al-Zahani outside the car.
The shopkeeper in Jerusalem's old city.
Al-Zahani looked up with a stern face.
I know him and detest him. He's a coward and a traitor. I should have shot him for desertion when I had the chance. My father would be alive today if it wasn't for cowards like Abu Hamad.
That may be. But I saw him last night and he told me a very interesting story. He said a private investigator hired by Sophie's father had been coming around his shop asking questions about you.
What was he asking?
If you made a deal to ransom your granddaughter.
Ransom? Where would he get such ideas?
Al-Zahani waved it off.
No matter. Sophie is safe. We're well protected.
But listen, Arif. He says the father is willing to pay millions of dollars to get her back. Tell Abu Hamad to go back to his junkyard. I'm not interested in such nonsense. Sophie is not for sale. That's insulting, but typical of Abu Hamad.
Wait,
Faiz said.
Do not dismiss this talk so readily. How many millions of dollars did Abu Hamad say?
Fakir raised his eyebrows.
He said, many millions.
Nizar laughed loudly.
Where is a young lawyer supposed to get many millions?
It's not impossible, Al-Zahani said. He has very wealthy friends. But this conversation is going nowhere. Sophie is not for sale.
How do you know his wealthy friends can pay millions, Arif?
Fayez asked. I met one such man, a Russian, a business client and friend of Summers. In fact, it was this man who flew Sophie, Lubana and me from Chicago last year. That's how we got here.
Some friend!
Nizar laughed.
Why would he let you steal Summers' daughter if he was his friend?
Al-Zahani shrugged. I didn't ask. Summers didn't let me steal the daughter. He gave it to me to watch while they went to Los Angeles. It was a bizarre situation, and one doesn't look a gift horse in the mouth. This man came into the hotel restaurant in Chicago where Lubana, Sophie and I were eating our breakfast. He told us that he and Summers had an emergency in Los Angeles, and he was very worried. He said $500 million was at stake, and that Summers was at the office at that very moment working on the deal. He asked me if Lubana and I could watch Sophie for a couple weeks while he and Summers went out of town. I told him that I had to get back to Hebron. I'm a doctor, and besides, I didn't want to violate the court order. Then he told me not to worry. They would take care of the court order, and if I wanted to, I could watch her at my home in Hebron. He'd fly us here and bring us back. He was a wealthy man who owned a jet plane. He was so confident, he left no doubt in my mind. Then, it all came to me. That's the way to get custody of Sophie. I thought this man was an eccentric, crazy man, but if I could get Sophie on a plane to Hebron, I'd certainly never bring her back to Chicago. So I told him, of course we will take care of Sophie, but you have to arrange for the flight and Sophie's passport. He said it's all done. He had Sophie's passport. He insisted we leave right away so we could get back to his meeting, which was okay with me. The sooner we got out of Chicago, the better. So we packed our bags, got in his limousine, and rode to some small private airfield where he kept his plane. His men flew us to Nova Scotia, then to Kiev, and then to Amman. 2 weeks came and went, and he didn't call. I never heard from him again.
So you think this man would now pay millions of dollars to get her back?
Al-Zahani shrugged. Maybe he's sorry for what he did. But what does it matter? Sophie is never going back to America, and I'm not talking to anybody about a ransom. Fayez held up a finger.
Not so fast. Millions of American dollars would be an immeasurable help in our struggle.
Al-Zahani straightened his back. Not for sale, Fayez. Not for any amount of money. And I'll hear no more of this.
Now the truth rises to the surface, Nizar said in a mocking tone. The dedicated freedom fighter, the holier-than-thou doctor who does not think twice of sacrificing young Danny in the cause of our struggle, would not part with his precious little American Jew, even though it would mean millions of dollars.
Fayez smiled broadly and stroked his wiry beard.
Do not stress, Arif. I will never ask you to part with Sophie. But I have a plan. A plan to get the money and still keep the little one. Now, let us get young Danny to the lab and finish the test.
Chapter 51. The bell on the coral reef's office door rang and Glenn shuffled out to the counter. The two men had returned.
I told you guys, I ain't never seen the man in the picture, and I don't know any Summerfield.
Summers, said the larger of the two.
Summers, not Summerfield.
Summers, Winters, don't matter. I don't know him, and wouldn't help no bill collectors if I did.
We'd like to see your register.
Go fuck yourself.
Why you make this so difficult?
The shorter man said in a rough accent.
We want only to look at register, just to see who check in and who check out. Then we leave you alone.
I ain't showing you shit. I don't have to, and I'm calling the cops if you don't get the fuck out of here.
The short man quickly pulled a .38 from his pocket.
I hate when people talk like that to me. Where is register?
Glenn reached under the counter and pulled out the book. He set it on the desk, never taking his eyes off the gun. The taller one scrolled through the entries with his finger, stopping midway down the page. He smiled at Glenn.
Mr. Wilson. Eugene Wilson. Room 212. Is this a picture of Mr. Wilson?
Glenn shrugged. His eyes were fixed upon the .38 in the short man's hand.
Why you make this so hard? You're either very brave or very stupid. How does he pay you? Does he use a credit card?
I don't take credit cards. He pays in cash.
Does he have a car?
Glenn shrugged.
I don't know.
The tall man reached out and grabbed Glenn's shirt at the throat. He pulled his face down to the counter.
We're trying to have a civil conversation. Don't you get it? Where is this motherfucker Wilson?
He moved out, I swear. His room's empty. You can check.
What kind of car does he drive?
Blue Acura.
Do you know the license number?
Glenn shook his head.
He got no license. He just bought it.
The man released Glenn, who stood, his face flushed, his pants wet.
I should shoot him,
the short man said.
Maybe. But I think this fat clerk has seen the light of day. You'll help us now, won't you?
The tall man took a pen off the counter and wrote a phone number on a slip of paper.
We'll be back soon. In the meantime, if you should hear from Wilson or Somers, you call us, understand? If we find out you tipped him off, oh, fuck it!
And the short man fired two rounds into Glenn's chest.
He said he moved out. If he's around here, this fuck would tip him off anyway. Let's get the hell out of here, Vigny. We'll find him ourselves. Wait. Maybe the cops can help us out.
Yevgeny retrieved his slip of paper, put it in his pocket, and drew a circle in the register book around the name of Eugene Wilson. Then he laid the open book on Glenn's arm.
They find this dead guy. They see the register and they want to know why Wilson's name is circled. Maybe they lead us to him. Maybe they arrest him. They got better resources than we do. And if they arrest him, we can pay him a visit in the jail.
Chapter 52. The sun rose over the tops of the old city towers and warmed the balcony on which Liam and Kayla were having breakfast. So, what time are we heading back to Hebron today? Kayla shook her head.
Fakir's son said he wouldn't be in for 2 more days. There's no reason to go before that.
Liam leaned forward and talked softly.
If you can get a van and maybe one other guy, I can grab Sophie on her way home from school. I've been thinking about it.
The street's wide open, 5 blocks from Al-Zahani's. Only one man comes to walk her home. We'd have the element of surprise and we can get her back to Jerusalem before they know what's going on. Kayla delicately poked her fork into a slice of melon. She did not look up or respond. Did you hear me? I can get her. This is a simple operation. I just need someone to detain the bodyguard. You've got friends in Hebron, friends with assault rifles who like to stop people and ask for IDs. Maybe take them in for questioning. We get Sophie, she goes home to her aunt, and the threat of paying millions to terrorists is over. Kayla's eyes were focused on her plate of fruit. She pushed the slices around with her fork. Finally, she raised her face.
We can't do that. We have to let this play out.
What?
It's too soon to break the operation.
Liam put his fork down.
I should have figured.
Damn it, Kayla, we can rescue that girl. She put her napkin on the table, walked to the railing, and pointed to the city.
Look, Liam, there's almost 1 million people out there, and somewhere in Hebron, there's a terrorist ring planning a horrible act. We don't know all the members or what they're planning. How and when will they strike? Is it already in place, and are they just waiting for the okay? Where will the strike be? Sophie gives us a reason to get close to them. She opens a door into the organization. She gets us inside the walls. If we pick her up now, snatch her off the streets, we'll lose any chance at further dialogue.
and they'll realize you weren't just some PI from Chicago.
Just some PI?
They'll know the agency's involved. We'll likely force the group further underground. We'll never learn who they are or what their plans are until it's too late.
So it's never been about the money or the girl. You're just using me to get close to the terrorists.
Not true. It's also about the money, and we do care about the girl. But don't you see? There's a jihadist cell planning a deadly operation, and I can't let it go down. Look out there. She waved her arm across the horizon. There are thousands and thousands of innocent people going about their daily business. Women, children, tourists, Muslims, Jews. Whatever Al-Zahani's group is planning will endanger all their lives, and I don't know enough to stop it.
How do you know, Kayla? How do you know this group is planning anything at all? How do you know they're not meeting to play checkers, because they've done it before?
This very group of bastards has killed innocent people before.
Kayla's voice caught in her throat.
And I need for them to pay for what they've done.
You can't make this personal, Kayla.
Kayla clenched her fists. Personal? Are you serious? Mass murderers killing innocent people indiscriminately are personal to me and should be to you as well. Terror for the sake of terror in furtherance of a political agenda is personal to me. Murder behind a pretense of holy war is personal to me and should be to anyone. And it isn't only what they're doing to their enemies, the so-called infidels or settlers. It's what they're doing to their own people. The millions of Palestinians who deserve better, like the folks we saw at lunch. It should make you incensed. Everyone should be outraged until there are no more terrorists.
She turned and faced Liam.
Israel is a speck of land. Take away the Negev Desert, and it's half the size of Vermont. You could fit 90 Israels into Saudi Arabia alone. It's a jewel in the desert, and they had no part in building it, yet it sticks in their craw. These Islamist militants, these jihadists, they just can't let it be. And there won't be peace, Liam, because they don't want peace. They want this jewel. They want to loot it, demolish it, and eradicate it until there is no more State of Israel. No more Jewish homeland. And what would be next for them? Peace? Not a chance. In this part of the world, civil war always follows so-called liberation. Look at Egypt, look at Iraq, look at Syria, Lebanon, Yemen. This entire region will be a battleground, and maybe that suits the sons of Canaan just fine. She grabbed Liam's arm. I need you to play out your role as private investigator trying to set up a ransom for the release of your client's daughter. Your cover is the perfect excuse to get close to Al-Zahani. And not just Al-Zahani, but whoever is the mastermind. It gets us inside the walls. But it serves your quest as well, because you'll get closer to Summers. I believe your assignment was to recover the money.
As you may remember, thanks to you, my assignment was broadened. Liam's cell phone buzzed in his pocket. He looked at the number and nodded.
Mr. Taggart, this is Jamal Abu Hamad. I have some interesting artifacts from Hebron I'd like to show you.
I can be there in half an hour. Liam looked at Kayla and raised his eyebrows. Abu Hamad, he's learned something. Chapter 53. Donnie awoke on a hospital bed with an IV in his arm, hooked up to a patient monitor measuring his heart rate, respiration, oxygen, blood pressure, and temperature. He pulled at his blue hospital gown tied in the back. A nurse sat beside the bed.
Where am I? You're at the clinic.
She smiled brightly.
Dr. Al-Zahani said you fainted, and he brought you here. You are very dehydrated, so we're giving you liquids. I don't remember that.
When can I go home?
She smiled and smoothed his covers.
The doctor will be here soon.
A few minutes later, Al-Zahani walked in.
Well, how's the patient doing?
He said to them both.
I think he feels better,
said the nurse.
I'm fine.
How did I get here?
I need to go home.
Al-Zahani sat in the corner of the bed.
Donnie, the best we can tell, you have a bad case of the flu. You fainted at the apartment and were quite dehydrated. Don't you remember?
He shook his head.
I remember walking to the apartment, but that's all. My mother doesn't want me to...
We know that, son. It's quite all right. You told us before you fainted. You had a fever of 102, which we have managed to bring down. Has anyone else in your family been ill?
Danny shook his head.
No, I don't think so. My mom said she didn't want me to... We know. You already told us. It's fine. Al-Zahani patted Danny on the arm.
We'll give the honor to someone else. When you're better, you'll come back and guard the door. You can go home in a little while after we finish hydrating you. But I want you to keep an eye on how you feel. If you start feeling bad again, I want you to call me right away, okay?
Sure, Doctor. Thanks. Just then, Al-Zahani's cell phone buzzed.
She's gone, Arif,
Lubana said in a hurried, hysterical voice.
Bashir went to her room to take her to madrasa, and she wasn't there. We looked all over the house. She's gone. She's not here. Oh, I'm so worried.
She's not gone, Lubana. She's just hiding in the house somewhere.
You're wrong, Arif. Her stuffed bear is also missing. She took it with her. She's run away, I tell you.
Stop crying, woman. Put Bashir on the phone.
Al-Zahani could hear Lubana's footsteps, her calls for Bashir, her intermittent sobs. Oh, my little one! My little Sophie! She cried.
Al-Zahani shook his head. Yes, Saeed, Bashir said. Are the gates closed?
Yes, Saeed.
Have they been closed all morning?
Since you left, sir.
Has the wall fallen down?
No, of course not.
Then she's still there. Find her, Bashir. Make certain she does not go into the laboratory. Post a guard at the lab door immediately, then search the grounds.
Yes, Saeed.
I will be home later.
Shall I call you when I find her?
No, just put her in her room and lock the door. I'll deal with her when I get home.
Madame Al-Zahani has asked if you are coming directly home.
Tell her no. I have important appointments all afternoon. Chapter 54. Abu Hamad held the cup to his lips and inhaled the vapors of the tea.
As I had promised you, I put out a fishing line to see what I could catch. I let it be known that I heard a man was willing to pay a royal sum for the little girl's return to her father. It did not take long for the comment to make its way to Fakir, the baker, which did not surprise me. I know him to be one of Arif's close associates. Fakir called me last night. Of course, I could only tell him what I had heard. A pure rumor, you understand, nothing more. Millions of dollars for the return of a child. Who knows if such a thing is true?
Fakir laughed it off. I myself pretended to laugh as well and retired for the night. Early this morning, Fakir walks into my shop. Jamal pointed his arthritic finger. He sits right there. He says, I have also heard rumors, Jamal, about $5 million. I say, why do you tell me this? He shrugs.
You say you heard rumors. I pass along further rumors, that's all, he says. People say if we are to believe the rumors, if a father loves his daughter so much, he would come to Hebron himself and bring $5 million. Not merely make rumors on the street. That is only way a man like Arif would even consider returning a little girl. And such a transfer should never be a public event or involve strangers. No one could ever expect a man like Arif to hand his precious little granddaughter over to anyone but the father himself, alone. It would surely be too traumatic for the little one to have others involved. Pure rumors, you understand. But that is what I have heard.
Liam stared quizzically. You believe him?
Do I believe that Arif gave that message to Fakir?
Yes.
Do I believe he intends to relinquish the girl?
No. Al-Zahani insists that Summers bring him the money alone? Does he expect Summers to walk down the streets of Hebron with a wheelbarrow full of money? A deep laugh resonated from Abu Hamad's chest.
It is a question I raised myself. Fakir responded that the details can always be worked out between reasonable men.
Liam stood to leave. Sounds like Summers would be headed to the gunfight at OK Corral. Abu Hamad shook his head.
Is that a movie?
It is, an old cowboy movie with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. Jamal smiled.
Old is a relative term in this store, but I would look for it on Amazon.
Abu Hamad held the door for Liam.
It should go without much more discourse that Arif cannot be trusted.
Understood. Abu Hamad reached for Liam's hand, placed a small dark coin in his palm, and closed Liam's fingers around it.
This is a Judean coin, almost as old as these hills.
Liam examined the beaten and misshapen disc, a chalice on one side and a tree on the other.
Thank you.
May the branches of the olive signal peace for this troubled land, and may we all drink sweet wine from the cup when it arrives. Godspeed, my friend.
Jamal watched Liam leave, then closed and locked his shop door. Back at the hotel, Liam explained his visit to Kayla. Abu Hamad told me that Al-Zahani wants $5 million in exchange for Sophie.
Wants? There was never a deal in place. Strange. Summers embezzles the money 2 months ago, and there's still no deal. What was this whole embezzlement thing about if not to ransom Sophie?
Liam shrugged.
Maybe Summers was just a pawn.
Evidently.
But the money is somewhere, and Summers either controls it or knows where it is.
In any event, Abu Hamad has given us good news. The door is now open.
What are the terms of the exchange? How and when are you supposed to deliver the money?
That's the tricky part. Al-Zahani will only make the exchange in Hebron directly with Summers, who he says must come alone.
With Summers? Why does he care whether it's Summers or someone else who hands over the money?
Well, he says it's because Sophie's so precious. He doesn't want to turn her over to anyone but her father.
He loves her so much that he kidnaps her, but he will return her for $5 million.
It's pretty obvious. He intends to kill Summers and keep the money.
No doubt. But now we have a problem. Without Summers, we can't maintain the facade or play out the exchange. He'll know it's an agency operation. He's not stupid. We need Summers, and we have no idea where he is.
Liam smiled smugly, a broad smile, and fluttered his eyelashes.
You bastard. Kayla put her hands on her hips. You know where he is. You've been holding out on me.
How did you find him?
Liam folded his arms across his chest.
Impressed, aren't you?
Well, yeah. Where is he?
Liam wagged his index finger.
I found him. I called the shots.
Agreed.
I want this in blood. I'm the first one to make contact. I don't want to lose him. I have a job to do.
Liam, I agree. You make the contact.
Liam nodded.
I'm pretty sure he's in Hawaii.
Kayla sighed. Ah, so are a million other people.
I know who he's staying with.
And an address?
No. But I'm sure you spies can come up with her address.
Then we need to return to the States and set up our trip to Hawaii. There's nothing more we can do here.
Cat, it's me.
Hi, me.
We're coming home.
Oh, that's fabulous. I've missed you. When do you get in?
I'm not exactly sure. Sometime tomorrow. We leave Israel late this evening. Unfortunately, I'm coming back empty-handed. No Sophie, no money.
Oh, I'm sorry you weren't more successful.
Well, not so fast. We made a little headway.
The last thing you told me was that you were going to meet with the shopkeeper. Was he able to find out anything more?
Quite a bit, actually. I'll tell you about it when I get home.
So, how would you like to go to Hawaii?
Is that a trick question?
When?
Right after I get back. I'm going to track down Summers. But, Liam, I have Kelson's deposition set for this week, and I can't change it.
Can't we go in 2 weeks?
No, honey, I'm sorry. I have to go right away.
Then I'm afraid you'll have to go alone.
Well, not exactly.
Oh, I get it. Miss State Department gets to go to Hawaii with my fiancé.
It's her operation, Kat. Of course she's going. Postpone the deposition and you can come with us.
Lawyers change deposition dates all the time.
I said I can't change the date, she snapped. It's set by court order. You know what? Just forget about it. Go with Miss State Department.
She's not with the State Department.
I'm not sure exactly who she's with, but she's definitely an intelligence agent. She's a spy.
Well, that makes me much more comfortable. I suppose she's not married either, is she?
No, Kat, she's not married. If you're so damn worried, then postpone the deposition and come with us.
Aren't you listening to me?
I can't postpone it. It's set in stone. And who says I'm damn worried?
This jealousy is very unlike you.
Really? What's like me?
Look, I'll be back in Chicago tomorrow. We can talk more about it then if you want. I don't think there's anything to talk about.
Liam paused. All right, I'll see you tomorrow. I love you. See you tomorrow.
Liam hung up, took a deep breath, and walked into the lobby where Kayla was standing by their luggage. Kayla noticed he was shaking his head.
Problems?
He shrugged. I don't really understand women.
Catherine?
He nodded.
How long have the two of you been together?
No, a long time if you go back to when we hung out in high school. But as a couple, just about a year.
You dated in high school?
No, I never had the nerve to ask her out. She was too pretty, too popular. We were just friends. Best friends, really. I was afraid to spoil that relationship by asking her out and screwing it up. Years later, we got together while working on a case.
But now you think there's problems in your relationship?
I didn't think so until recently. We've had a couple of awkward conversations. Now she seems real upset about my going to Hawaii.
Is she worried about you traveling without her?
Globe-trotting with the femme fatale?
Is that what you are?
The femme fatale? She smiled. Liam shook his head again. I don't know. Once she told me she wanted to go to Hawaii on her honeymoon.
Are the two of you getting married?
I always assumed so. She brought it up the other night, but I totally dropped the ball. Now she doesn't want to talk about it. I told her I'd be happy to discuss it.
You'd discuss it? Did you ever ask her to marry you?
You mean, like, right out? Will you marry me?
Kayla smiled. That's usually the way it's done.
Not in those words. I've asked her if she wanted to talk about it.
Very romantic.
Kayla picked up her bag.
Thanks for your incisive analysis. I told you, I don't understand women.
Kayla smiled and bit her bottom lip.
Is it so hard for you to understand that your girlfriend might be jealous? I experienced a few of those Irish moves outside of Al Zahani's house. And I have to admit, there's some style there. Maybe she wants to protect her property. I'd be jealous too.
Just then, the agency car pulled up, and they loaded their luggage for the ride to the airport. Chapter 55. Al-Zahani unlocked the door to Sophie's bedroom. She was sitting on her bed, rocking back and forth, clutching her bear tightly to her chest. He sat on the edge of the bed.
Where did you go today?
Outside.
Why did you hide?
Sophie pressed her lips and looked away.
Answer me, Sophie.
I want to go home, she snapped.
You are home. This is your home. Are you so foolish you think you can walk across an ocean? Do you think your Judah and I will not find you wherever you go?
I want my daddy. I want my home, she said defiantly.
He put out his hands and cupped her face tightly.
Listen to me. He is gone from your life. You will never see him again. Your mother, your father, they are not here for you anymore, ever. Stop this useless pining.
He is not gone, Sophie yelled. He will find me, and when he does, you'll be sorry.
Al-Zahani slapped her on the cheek.
You will not disobey me again. You will not disrespect me or your Judah.
The door opened, and Lubana, responding to the cries, walked a few tentative steps into the room.
Leave us, woman!
Al-Zahani snapped. Lubana stood at the doorway.
Arif, please, I said leave us! Now go! I will handle this!
Lubana hung her head and left the room, shutting the door behind her.
You will suffer punishment for what you have done, Sophie. There will be no dinner today. If you run again, I will tie you to your bed.
Al-Zahani stood and looked down at her with a stern face.
Do not disobey again.